John and I are not volunteering at Holden Village. Our day job, so to speak, is doing the development work for a large proposed agricultural project in the Ozarks, southwest Missouri, near Springfield. Our purpose in this project is to develop a model new agricultural system that can be replicated for other communities. Across the nation, we see a problem with our local food supplies dwindling away as small farmers are forced out by global competition, and a growing partisan divide between people of different political persuasions. So our goal here is to look for common factors that unite people, somewhat in the line of what Travis's work is in conflict resolution. So what unites everyone, and that is food. Almost everyone. Food, love of children, hope for the future. And so we live in a deeply red area in the Ozarks. And so our goal has been to find these common factors that bind people together to create opportunities for young people and to restore a sense of hope to rural communities as well as to young people looking for a goal for the future. So that's our underlying purpose, and we've developed a plan over the last 3 years working with hundreds of different stakeholders how to accomplish this and how to do it using a business for good instead of relying upon endless and somewhat undependable sources of foundation funding or altruistic grants. To look for a way to utilize wastage in our food system and recycle those dollars and create local opportunities. So, John.
Thank you for the introduction and thank you all for being here today. I want to echo the point about what Travis shared today about the idea of bringing people around ecological resources and finding common ground regardless of your political persuasion. And I think at the core of this is about bringing people together and using food to do that. And so whenever you listen to this presentation, we'll try to talk about how this is very much a sustainability, what we call a regenerative agricultural project. Now we're in Trump country, so we don't necessarily use the word sustainable, regenerative, green. So we'll talk a little bit about how we speak the language of the culture and understanding that a lot of the folks that we're talking to, they have a very deep land ethic, they would say, or a sense of stewardship. And so using words that open doors and don't close doors is really important for the success of this, because we're a lot of the decision makers that have made this happen are not necessarily what we would consider progressive, so we have to use words that they'll resonate with. I want to give a little bit of context about the Ozarks. I know you coastal folks know us affectionately as flyover country. Here we are. We like to say in the heart of America, the heartland. Main Street, not Wall Street. One thing about Springfield, we're about an hour away from the population center of the United States. This is significant for our project. We'll talk about this a little bit more because of distribution costs of produce. Most of the produce that we buy in the Ozarks comes from, much like most of the country, from Central Valley, California. So it takes about 2,000 miles to get to us. So the fact that we're right in the middle of the country, literally, this has a really powerful narrative that resonates with people, but also a very powerful business case that makes this an even more viable business that's also business for good. Springfield is the home of, maybe you've heard of him, Brad Pitt. Bass Pro Shops is headquartered there. Bob Barker, The Price is Right, from Springfield. Kind of a big deal. And hopefully Noble Hill someday. So we're about 4 million people within, 7 million people within a 4-hour service area. So there's a lot of opportunity to sell produce at a large scale. So what we're talking about here is not just farmers markets. It starts there, but it doesn't end there. It grows to a large commercial level distribution, analogous to what you're seeing in California and other parts of the country. So this is just to familiarize that. We also have a large university population, which is important for what we're doing for our workforce of educating young farmers in field-based agriculture, specialty crop production, but also in hydroponics, which is a growing field and a very good employment prospect for people that want to be involved with that. Mike mentioned this before. This is about food, but it's really about so much more. Mike and I have met with people from all sides of the political spectrum, and I think one thing we find in common we do disagree about a lot of stuff, and I think it's fundamentally American to disagree about stuff. But there are things that we do agree on, and so finding the words to bring people together into shared experiences that make this more part of our heritage and less about a contentious sustainability thing that some people are polarized about. I don't know, many of you have heard of Senator Roy Blunt. He was the MC of the inauguration with Joe Biden, the guy that introduced the poet laureate and all those people. So he's our senator, one of our senators. And we met with his field representative, who is this kind of crusty, hard-boiled, you know, Republican operative. And one thing that was really fascinating about that, talking to him, he talked about as a kid snapping peas on the back porch with his grandma. And that was an experience that he remembered. You know, we didn't have a lot, but we had enough. And that was just like everybody else in the country. We grew what we needed, and everybody had enough. That image was the exact same image I heard from an African-American food activist in New Orleans, not a few months later at a Food Hub conference. And the same image of snapping peas in the back porch. So when we talk about this, there's a very fundamental ground level connection that if we can tap into that sense of not nostalgia, but we've been here before, we're not creating something new, we're returning to something that we already knew, that our grandparents knew, that even some of us knew as kids, that's a really powerful story that resonates with Red America, because it's comforting. I want to talk a little bit about the history of our project. This is very much a public-private partnership, bringing together the resources of our city of Springfield, our city utilities, and private enterprise, working with nonprofits to make a difference in people's lives. The city of Springfield, where we live, has a power plant that uses waste methane from the city landfill. One of the byproducts of the methane power generation is a tremendous amount of waste heat. So the city thought, how can we take this waste, figuratively and literally waste heat, turn it into a resource? They did some studies and they found out that you could heat up to 8 acres of hydroponic greenhouses. One of the biggest costs of running a hydroponic greenhouse is actually heating it, particularly in peak production, peak demand times, January, February, where it's harder to grow stuff in the ground. Greenhouses can get a really good price on their leafy greens and tomatoes. So being able to heat that is a big business advantage, as well as a powerful sustainability story. Or if you're from the Ozarks, we're thrifty, we don't like to waste stuff, turn waste into something valuable. Trash into tomatoes, as some people say, that we're not going to grow tomatoes. And we're not growing it on trash either. So the city of Springfield put out what's called a request for proposal. They said, we really want to do this, we want to partner with private enterprise. They put out a request for proposal. Mike and I responded. We've been working with one of the, ironically, one of the O'Reilly Automotive family members, who is a big proponent of sustainability, so that's long-term thinking. So we put together a package and applied for this. We were accepted to do this, but Mike and I are not farmers. We are more entrepreneurs, business people. We recognized that before we designed a solution, whatever it was going to be, we really needed to understand what the problems were. And to do that, we just had to get out of the building and talk to people. So we talked to hundreds of people. We created business plans. We combed through USDA market reports of what people are actually paying for produce. We talked to large wholesale buyers on every level, from Hy-Vee to some of the large distributors in the South. We met with congressional leaders, we met with farmers, we met with school teachers. We really wanted to understand what the needs were before we designed something. And this is what we've learned from our conversations. First of all, as I mentioned before, and when I talk about the Ozarks, what I'm talking about in the Ozarks is probably true, unless you live in Central Valley, California, is probably true for everybody in this room. Most of the food you eat is not grown in the region that you live in. In the Ozarks, the average box of produce travels about 1,500 miles from farm to table. What that means practically is that it's coming from Central Valley, California, or from Mexico. And one surprising thing, do any of you all know the second largest food producer in the world for specialty crops? You'll probably never guess if you don't know it. I just want to hear some words out of it. What country is it?
Oh, what country? For crops, you said?
Yeah, by cash value. Any guesses?
California.
Country. Mm-hmm. Not in the United States. Mm. The Netherlands.
The Netherlands?
Yeah. So if you go to the supermarket in Springfield, in the Ozarks, in April or March, the bell peppers are typically from the Netherlands. And I think that's crazy, especially when you know a little bit about the history of the Ozarks, which at one point was one of the leading specialty crop producers in the nation, that it's somehow cheaper for us to air freight bell peppers from wooden shoes, you know, windmills, the canals, than it is to grow it ourselves. So we're trying to change that. We talk to these buyers, they say that it costs about, it's really not $5,000, it's actually $7,000 just in freight costs to ship in a truckload of lettuce from Central Valley, California. By the time it gets here, it's over 7 to 10 days old, and because of that, it's a perishable. A third of it gets thrown away either by the buyer, by the consumer, or by the distributor. So that's a real lost, economic loss, and it's also freshness, nutrition, and just experience lost, just because we're growing it 2,000 miles away. The other thing that we learned is that it's no surprise to us that consumer demand for local food is growing. This is not just for people that go to farmers markets, but it's also becoming more and more mainstream. Places like Walmart, Hy-Vee is a big proponent of local food. We didn't hear this just from the people that we met at the farmers market. We heard it from really large produce buyers. They want to buy local food because they know it's going to sell. Farmers also get a better price selling local food, and we'll talk a little bit more about what it means to be a farmer in this food economy. So we're going to talk a little bit more about how we arrived at this conclusion, but this is kind of what we came upon, is this could be a solution for our food system. One thing to remember is that the food system very much is a system. You can imagine it like a three-legged stool, a three-legged bar stool or milking stool, whatever you want to think about. If you remove one of those legs, it's not stable, it's going to fall over. So the first leg of this is a hydroponic greenhouse. This builds up a market relationship with large buyers that need produce year-round and at scale, consistency that they can integrate it into their store systems, for lack of a better word. This also generates the cash to support all these other things, so it's financially sustainable. Mike might talk about not being dependent on grants. The other leg of the stool is, right now our farmers are getting older and older every year, about 60 years old and getting older. It's almost impossible to start a farm if you weren't born on a farm. So we need to create a path forward for these farmers to get started. What we've envisioned is a proven model that other places in the country have used called the Young Farmer Accelerator. Some people call them incubators that help young farmers grow produce and develop their business model and become bankable to qualify for bank financing and learn how to become a farmer. The other thing is something called a food hub, a third leg of the stool. It's difficult to make a living selling just to farmers markets. That's what we learned talking to people. The next step beyond that is being able to sell in grocery stores, restaurants, school cafeterias. What's needed is something called a food hub, which is basically a warehouse that your farmer can bring their produce to. It bridges the gap between the people that want to buy produce on a large scale and the farmers that want to grow it. And there's some complexity there. We'll talk about that too. So these are the three legs of the stool. This is what our food system looks like. I want to talk a little bit about the struggles that farmers are facing. Right now, they are struggling to survive. In the Ozarks, or in Missouri in general, about 95% of the farmers are what we call conventional farmers, growing soybeans, corn, wheat. And the markets that they're selling into are large, global commodity markets that are subject to the international price fluctuations of that market. So no one's selling wheat at the farmer's market unless it's a locally grown, branded kind of thing, make Bob's Red Mill kind of stuff out of. And it's almost impossible to be profitable as a farmer like this. In fact, with growing consolidation of farms, the only way that these people are profitable because of equipment costs and fluctuations is if they're very, very big. So the trend that we're seeing with farms is that they're getting bigger and bigger and being swallowed up by large mega corporation farms or private equity owned farms. We've learned talking to people, not just at the farmers market, but these kind of farmers, 90% of farmers in, I think in America, probably safe to say in America, derive more than half of their income from off the farm jobs. So even a guy like this, who might even have 2,000 acres, he cannot afford to run his farm and send his kids to school or put a roof over his head and feed himself. He needs a second job working at a gas station or working as an insurance agent. And so one thing we're thinking, if we're going to make farming a viable opportunity, it has to be profitable sufficiently so people can actually make a living doing that. And as I mentioned before, these buyers also want local food. All these people we've talked to, Mercy is a large hospital in our region. Compass Chartwell's is food service for public universities. They have a 20% mandate to source 20% of their produce and their food locally, and they're desperate to find producers to do it. So there's definitely a business case. The challenge is getting people to grow the produce. I just skipped the slide. So the way that we do that is this food hub distribution center. It basically creates more money for farmers by giving them a larger market and expanding what they can sell into. If you think about the farmer's market, it's only usually open one day a week in our region it is. So you can imagine if you're a business owner, your stores are only open one day a week, or maybe a Tuesday morning, whatever you are, a lawyer, an insurance agent, you know, a sporting goods store, a restaurant, it's really difficult to make a living that way. And so farmers markets are just not sufficient to address the need, but also the business imperative of making a living for farmers. The food hub bridges the gap between these farmers that want to grow their businesses bigger. It gives them markets to sell into. And we've talked to large buyers, as I mentioned before. You know, they say, we desperately want to buy local food, but it has to be easy for us. Like, they get three calls a week from farmers to say, hey, I've got a load of tomatoes, I'm ready. You know, and these groups have, like, literally banana ripening rooms and are shipping out, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds a day of produce. You can't just show up with a pickup of beets that you grow in the back 40 and expect to sell it to them. It has to be in their system. You have to point and click and be able to buy farmers' produce. So this creates that system that makes it possible to sell their produce, the farmers' produce, to these large buyers because they desperately want to buy it. The good thing about the food hub is that it not only creates jobs at the food hub, imagine a big warehouse receiving local farmers' produce, but also has the indirect effect of creating more farmer jobs in the community. We've talked to Missouri University Extension. They tell us that for every $1 million of sales through the food hub, it creates about 20 jobs off the food hub and local farms. So it's very much an economic boost for farm employment. And also, whenever you send your money to California or Mexico or the Netherlands, that money is getting sucked out of the economy and goes to their economy. When it stays in the community, there's something called the economic multiplier effect that recycles those dollars to buy shoes or the restaurant, you know. And it creates an added benefit of keeping that money in the community. So there's a lot of benefit here. The other challenge we talked about is helping young farmers get started. How does that work? As I mentioned before, the average age of farmers in America today is about 6 years old. It's getting older and older every year. So there's a very real pressing concern that who is going to grow our food in the future? Because there's just not enough farmers to do that. What's happening is a lot of these farms get sold in auction because there's no one there to take it over, and they get bought up by larger farms or they get developed into something else. So we're really losing that knowledge base and that infrastructure of people to grow our food. One reason for this is that it's almost impossible to start farming in America today unless you inherited a farm. This is what you need to start a farm. You need money, obviously, to buy your farm and buy your equipment. You need to have land. You need to know how to grow food, be a farmer, but equally important, you're a small business. You need to know accounting, finance, marketing, sales, inventory management, all the things that are needed. So, and you also need access to profitable markets, like a food hub. So if you don't have all of these, it's almost impossible to start farming, which is why almost no one starts farming today. Now, I think it's a helpful reframe for people to think about how dire this situation is. Imagine a world in which you had to be born into a doctor's family to be a doctor, or you had to be born into an insurance agent family, or a pastor's family, or an engineer's family, or a plumber's family, or Holden Village Maverick family, to make it really real. Fortunately, it's not this way. We have a clear training path for all these careers. We have schools and internships. You can easily be financed to pursue this path, knowing that you'll have a job on the other end. And as I said before, you don't have to be born into a doctor or an engineer or a maverick family to become one. So why should farming be any different? That's what we want to ask. And I think it's really helpful to frame that because we have this romantic notion that it's a family farm, I'm going to inherit it. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a really powerful story and a way forward for business. It's happened before, but if that's the only way to do it, we really have a problem with farming. So how do we fix that? I'm a baseball fan. My team is the St. Louis Cardinals, bless their hearts, they're not doing very well this year. If you think about the Cardinals, or the Mariners, or the Twins, or whatever your team is, those professional ball players didn't start in the major leagues. They didn't start playing baseball in the minor leagues. They didn't start really in college. Most of them started early on, T-ball, Little League, American Legion. What's true for baseball or basketball is also true for farming. You don't just start as a professional bankable farmer. You need to have exposure and experience from an early age, ideally, and learn those skills and just become familiar with it. In the same way we teach math in fourth grade, we don't start teaching math in graduate school to become an engineer. So what does that farm team literally look like to build up our next generation of farmers? The need is there. Mike and I have met with our public school teachers at Springfield School District, and they tell us there are a lot of young people that have a strong desire to contribute, a lot of energy, but understandably struggle in a classroom setting. And I think you understand what that looks like. Kids that have ADHD or rough family lives or just temperamentally are not suited for sitting still for 8 hours a day. I know I certainly am not. They tell us these same young people that are wild, for a lack of a word, the way we want to say it, they come alive in a different way when they visit a hydroponic greenhouse or visit a farm for the first time or see chickens laying eggs. This is like a whole new kid. And part of the mission of Noble Hill is to help these young people envision a different path for themselves, that they too can contribute to their community by growing food, and maybe that farming would be a way for them to be productive and creatively engaged with their community in a way that they never envisioned before with school. And I think the earlier we can do that, the more we can foster the spark in their imagination to imagine a different path forward for them. At its core, this project is about transforming waste resources, wasted land, wasted heat, wasted electricity into food and opportunity. But I think the biggest tragedy in our community today is young people whose lives are wasted because they never imagined a path forward for them. And I think that we can do a lot of good by giving people different ways to make a living and envision how they engage in their world. And this is one way they've done that. So this school district, once we build this, are very interested in bringing kids out for tours and then having progressive internships with high school students and then through our local technical college and university to give them progressive learning experience and internships to progress to the next level. But like the farm team, you start with T-ball, not with major league. Once they have done this, obviously it's not enough to go to school to become a viable farmer. You actually need to know how to grow stuff and run a real business. This Ag Accelerator gives people real world farming experience on leased land, running their own farms under mentorship with other farmers about their age. So you can apply to be a part of this. You lease land, you pay a small land use fee and equipment, shared equipment fee. You get valuable mentorship in not only how to grow food, but also how to run a business, which we found talking to farmers. Virtually every farmer we've talked to doesn't know how to run a business or really struggles with it. They didn't get into it to be an accountant. They got into it to be a farmer. But a lot of that is around a lot of fear of business, and demystifying that is an important part of making our farmers be successful and run successful businesses. The exciting thing about this is that the USDA has financing for new farmers. They typically require about a 3-year track record of commercial experience to qualify for USDA bank loans and Small Business Association loans. It's kind of a chicken and egg thing. They're not going to loan money to you to start a farm if you just say, I'm going to start a farm. Fortunately, this accelerator program is a proven way to give people that 3-year track record of commercial farming experience to learn the trade but also qualify for financing. So those problems before we talked about of access to capital, that goes away when they go through a program like this. So it's not only learning to become a farmer, but it's also a path forward to buy your own farm and transition off of the accelerator onto the land around. The big question, though, is how do we pay for this? What we're doing is unique in the sense that we're bringing this together in a systems-based, but the Ag Accelerator, the Food Hub, the Greenhouse, particularly the Food Hub and the Ag Accelerator, all of these have been tried and generally have been successful, but almost all of them have fallen far short of their potential because they lack a consistent cash flow to support the mission. You can imagine running this school for young farmers and is not exactly a cash cow, if we put it that way. So how do we actually make this sustainable, not only environmentally, but financially sustainable to make the long-term change that we need to make this a real systems change? It didn't go away overnight, the farming system. It took about 70 years, and it's not going to come back in 3 years. So we need to make this financially sustainable. That's where the hydroponic greenhouse comes in. This is our competitive business advantage. We have a couple things going for us. free heat from the city, free land, about $100 a year. And then because we're in the middle of the country with a lot of wind power and very limited distribution, we have an off-peak renewable wind power available to us from 11 o'clock at night to 7 in the morning. It's about 3 cents per kilowatt hour with no demand charges, which if you're a power person, you know that's really cheap. That turns out to be really good for running hydroponic grow lights. So all these combined create a really strong business advantage. Hydroponics in general are about 10 times more productive than field agriculture in terms of your yield. So if you can grow 4 pounds a year in the field, you can grow 40 pounds a square foot per year in a hydroponic greenhouse. And because we're co-located with these large distributors, you don't have those, you know, boxes of produce that, like the California produce, maybe not here, but in the Ozarks, has been aged to perfection through a long cross-country truck ride. It's fresh when you get it, which translates into a real business premium for our buyers and for us. But this is not only just a profitable greenhouse, it's profit with a purpose. This, look around the room, or particularly in a conservative state like that, where everybody wants to cut programs, we really need to create a long-term financial viability for this so we're not dependent on grants. We have nothing against grants. They're wonderful. I think there should be more of them. But just looking at the way things are going, creating a sustainable cash flow makes this much more viable to make the change that's necessary that will take more than a couple years to do. So this eliminates the grant dependency, develops profitable markets, and then we'll fund the young farmer training. This talks a little bit about the jobs that are created with this. We have other things, jobs created off-site through the food hub. We want to do an agroforestry demonstration. So the Ozarks is one of the best places for growing blackberries, it turns out. But if you go to the supermarket, most of the blackberries are from California. What we want to do, because we live in Missouri, is called the Show Me State. It's not enough to talk about it. You have to show people. Imagine coming to a place like this and seeing blackberries growing, but not only growing, but also sold through the food hub next door to it. Stuff like that gives people confidence to say, maybe I don't need to run cattle or rent out my land and run it for $50 an acre per year, which is what people charge in the Ozarks for land. There might be more profitable ways to use my land that's also better for the land and better for the water. So it's not enough to talk about it, you have to show people, and that's one way that we're talking about doing it. This is a little bit of our timeline. This is an ambitious project. We're going to start with the hydroponic greenhouse, which is the most profitable thing. It builds up credibility with these large buyers that want to buy local farmers' produce. And with that credibility, we can incorporate local farmers' produce locally, or later seasonally, on a seasonal basis through the food hub, once we have that credibility with the large buyers. After we open up the food hub, we'll open up the young farmer training thing. And we think that this is a model, if appropriate, could really work in other regions, because there's hundreds of sources, really thousands of sources of waste heat, not only landfill power plants, but also data centers, industrial facilities, you know, laundry facilities. So we think this is a very scalable and replicable solution that could work in other regions of the country. This is a little bit about the site map. You all are not from the Ozarks, so this probably doesn't mean as much in terms of the location. It's north of Springfield. But the real take home from this is kind of like Holden Village. You come here, it's a destination, and it's an ecosystem of, you've got the pottery studio, the worship center, the food, the Maverick. There's a buzz and a hive of activity. We want to bring people out there and not only have things located next to them for ease of use, but also create a sense of, this is what our food future could look like. A beautiful place with, you know, agroforestry, lawns, meeting places, park benches. People can bring their families out, because a lot of the change that has to happen, it's not just a technical challenge, it's a perception challenge. And people don't make decisions with their brain, they make them with their hearts and their feelings and their emotions. And you can go to a place like this and it feels good to be there. That changes the narrative of what sustainability and regenerative things look like for our community. So this is just a recap. Restoring our food independence, which is a word that Republicans like because it sounds vaguely food security, food independence, you know, a little drumbeat there. It brings people together, creating a path forward for young farmers to get started and also be a repeatable example for other communities to follow. That's our presentation. We'd love to take your questions, your comments, your criticisms, your insights. Bring Mike up to the microphone.
if you're able to share.
Yeah.
Hope for the future. A dawning realization that the direction our nation is going in has left a lot of people with a sense of hopelessness. And you see that manifested in a dramatic increase in drug dependency, suicide among people of all ages, but especially teenagers, 20 and 30-year-olds. It seems to us that we need to restore our country and start off with things that we can agree on. Most everybody wants good, safe food. Most everybody has children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews. They want the hope for them. I think we all are aware of families who've lost loved ones due to alcoholism, drugs, just general diseases of despair. And so while we can't solve all the world's problems, we think that the resources exist to at least take an approach that can be replicated by other communities, because between sources of industrial waste heat, data centers, there's hundreds of thousands of young people looking for careers, there's hundreds of millions of people buying food. So the ingredients to apply this type of solution exist in most every community in America, and frankly in other countries as well. So while we can't save the world, we're thinking, well, maybe we can start with an example, a small example in a most unlikely place, the reddest district in the United States, the 7th Congressional District.
We're like two Democrats, Mike and I there, so.
Well, no, we have family members that are Democrats, too.
I'm curious, we're in the cherry and apple farming business in central Washington. And in Washington, consolidation's been driven by the market, you know, because of Walmart and Kroger and so forth. There's been so much consolidation on the retail side that you have to scale up to meet that. And I guess you guys have the advantage of being able to grow a number of different crops. But do you see any ability in the future to go into some DCs for distribution centers for like Walmart or Kroger or others that are on a big scale basis?
So, yeah, part of it, and this is one thing about the hydroponic greenhouse, just starting with the greenhouse, is that when we talk to them, the minimums that they require to sell what they call their slots of leafy greens, they're so huge that no farm, like a lot of people ask us, aren't you going to compete with local farmers and like knock them out of business? We're not competing with local farmers, we're competing with California. So it's true, you need a certain amount of scale to even have the conversation. A 3-acre hydroponic greenhouse is there for focusing on leafy greens and other things. Now, as far as the other farmers that would be a part of this, the value of building the credibility through an anchor brand like Noble Hill Hydroponic Greens is that you can also, you know, a lot of farmers, they want to have their own brand, but a lot of farmers don't want to brand and do all the business. They'd be happy selling under a different brand and be a supplier for that. You can leverage the variety of producers and have quality requirements and inspections, but then sell under the umbrella brand of Noble Hill that's already been established through the leafy green. So that's where you can start to get to the scale where you can integrate into the larger buyers like Walmart or Hy-Vee or, you know. Yeah, but one thing that's been surprising, we found that Walmart is its own animal that would be challenging to work with. But a lot of these large buyers are surprisingly willing to work with local producers, and they've told us about the ones that they're working with. There's a really strong sense of stewardship and commitment to build up those farmers that they are, there's a lot of opportunity there in our region.
Yeah, one thing about the Ozarks is that we're blessed with a fairly moderate climate, lots of rainfall. In fact, before everybody moved to Washington State, like Johnny Appleseed, Missouri was actually the nation's leading producer of apples. Mm-hmm. And the climate works better in Washington State for apples than it does in Missouri. But there's lots of very entrepreneurial small farmers. There's lots of relatively inexpensive land. There's lots of opportunities. But as John was saying, that we start off with this greenhouse, we create a prominent local brand name that's displayed year-round in terms of these readily available leafy greens. And then that creates a brand awareness that enables small farmers who are growing products on a 2 or 3 season basis to plug their products under this same brand name through the food hub. So we create this, like a line extension, if you're familiar with these marketing terms. So we create more value. In other words, instead of you just being a farmer selling on a roadside stand, you can still do that under your own name. But if you can plug into these large distribution centers, like we're having good discussions with Associated Wholesale Grocers, who's the largest grocer wholesaler in the country. And one of their major distribution centers is right down the road from us. So there's a lot of institutional support for buying local food, because your large buyers are very sensitive to the fact that with the growing climate uncertainties and changes in transportation, that sourcing a lot of things thousands of miles away is in fact a business risk, and one that they would like to minimize.
You said the first big step is building the greenhouse.
Mm-hmm.
What's the capital for that, and how are you getting that together?
It's about three greenhouses are surprisingly expensive. When I thought of a greenhouse when I started, I thought, okay, like a hoop house where you can grow basil, you know, 3 seasons out of the year, and wouldn't that be fun? Let's do that. These are, and part of it's the cannabis industry. It's driven up the cost of hydroponic greenhouses. And a 3-acre greenhouse, including working capital, so you incur a significant cost of growing produce for 6 to 8 weeks before you can sell it, and then you don't get paid for maybe 60 days. So all that combined is about $17 to $18 million. It depends, including the developer fee and the concrete pad and, you know, what are called soft costs that are on top of the hard costs of building something, but designers, so about $18 million. The good news is that this is something, the way that we want to set it up is something that provides a portion of the profits to support the young farmer training and the food hub and just general community betterment through food. But one thing that we realize is not just making it sustainable, but also sustainable in that investors can get their money back at a risk-adjusted rate. So we've been talking to private investors, individuals that want a return on their capital, but also foundations that they have what are called program-related investments. They're using the toolkit of venture capital or bank financing, but investing in businesses such as ours that fulfill some charter of their foundation, like helping local farmers develop. Because of that, you can qualify for lower rates on bank loans. And through the foundation fulfills a legal requirement to disperse a certain percentage of their capital every year. So foundations, investors, yeah, talking to government officials about making this part of an infrastructure thing as well. So we're talking to a lot of people, and we're going to ask you guys to look in the couch cushions over there too.
Burgers quarters lurking underneath some of those cushions.
Or even take your ice cream punch card on the Golden Black Market. That's a good 66 on the
To follow up a little bit, these are kind of like computer clean rooms in a sense. They're positive pressure, so you're filtering the air, you're blowing it into the greenhouse, you step up a little pool of disinfectant, you're wearing Tyvek suits. So the whole idea is to grow this without any chemicals. I mean, these are truly certified organic products. One of the reasons we get a lot of interest from hospitals is that they have a lot of people who are immune compromised. And there's been, I'm sure you all have seen a lot of stories about the salmonella outbreaks and different types of products.
E. coli and
they just had another big one for chicken.
Oh, they did.
Yeah.
Yeah, just today I saw.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of that comes from the irrigation water that's being used is often runoff from confined animal feeding operations, or feedlots, mm-hmm. some people call it. So this is high dollar, but it's highly productive and creates a real premium product to create the kind of brand image that we can then use to help local farmers be profitable. Thank you.
Are you the one and only, or are there more similar projects?
In what way? You mean?
Are there any other things in the United States that are similar to what you're doing?
All the elements that we're talking about, Young Farmer Training Program, there are probably about 100 of those in the nation. Food Hub, there's probably under 100 of those. There are a lot of hydroponic greenhouses. There are a couple that are using waste heat. To our knowledge, we're the first people to bring it all together in a total system. So you remember the stool. The most healthy way that we can help this is to take a systems approach. So I think that we will be the first in the nation to integrate these all, which is kind of the way that, I mean, it sounds like it is an ambitious project, but if we think about less as like a linear business, you know, we think about an assembly line, we have ecosystems that have been around for millions of years. That's the way that things work, is ecosystems, and this is really an ecosystem model to doing business.
Yeah, to follow up on your question, there's a lot of food hubs. Very few of them actually make money. Most of them are nonprofits. Most of them are run mostly by volunteers. And so they're, you know, on the scale of a few hundred thousand to maybe a couple million dollars a year. And to make a food hub profitable, and they're not, because you want to return as much money as possible to your producers, you're looking at having to get up into $5 to $10 million range. And there's just...
In sales.
There's just a handful of food hubs that are that large.
Sure, so they're usually making about $1 in every $100 in revenue, so it's a 1% profit. So it's very, very...
There's a lot of young farmer training programs, but to our knowledge, virtually all of them are very small. They're well-intentioned efforts that are extremely dependent upon external sources of funding from state or federal or foundations. And so for a program like this to work, you need sustained funding, because it does take 3 years of training and experience for farmers to qualify. And then once you do qualify, what is that young farmer going to do? He's going to go sell at the roadside stand or the farmer's market, for the most part. That's a really hard way to make a living. But if they can scale up, they can become bankable, and then have the food hub to sell it to, we give them really a path forward to a degree of commercial success. So,
you mentioned briefly Senator Blunt and meeting with him. What was his overall,
very excited. We didn't meet with Roy Blunt.
Right. And he's retiring.
His handler, yeah.
We've met with our local congressional representative, Billy Long, who's now running for Senator Blunt's spot.
Yeah, and then we've met with the county commissioners, who are all, you know, Republicans. It's all been very enthusiastic, supportive, because we're not talking about a regenerative project. We're talking about bringing the families back to the rural areas, giving a path forward for farmers to be successful, you know. There's a lot of resentment in rural areas, understandably, because, and I think it's well-deserved, kind of a feeling of elitism from coastal areas or progressives or blue states. And so giving them, more than anything, it's about having a powerful narrative and a story and a sense of hope and bragging rights about, like, look what we've done, first in the nation, right here in the Ozarks. Y'all can learn something from here, you know. And that's the way that we talk to them, is like, let's play to our strengths to show people what we can
Absolutely.
Do. And they love it. They eat it up. And we need their help, too. So it's not just about, like, yeah, we definitely need their support, and we want their support. And I think also, you know, it's funny language that people use. I was talking to someone who's a green building person. They said, when I'm selling the green building in, you know, parts of Idaho or Kansas or Texas, I don't say it's a green building, I say it's a high-performance building. So, and that makes all the difference. So So we're high performance greenhouses. We're not just sustainability greenhouses.
And that's why we really enjoyed Travis's program this morning, because he is utilizing very similar concepts to help reconcile the conflicts between various environmental, ranching, governmental interests. Mm-hmm. So in our own small way, that's what we're trying to accomplish here.
Maybe I can use you guys as a case study this fall.
We hope so. Yeah, and if you know any real estate investors, these sorts of projects qualify for accelerated depreciation. So five to 7 year accelerated depreciation. So you can depreciate the entire structure 7 years or less, mm-hmm. as opposed to like apartments or commercial buildings are like 39 years. So,
and one thing that we're trying to think about this also is that a lot of people ask, is this going to be for profit, not for profit? Not for profits, it'll be a for profit greenhouse owned by an umbrella not for profit, and that increasingly, the way that I look at business is that business is a tool. It's a wonderful tool. It's a terrible master. Like, if we're thinking just about the profit potential, and that's your only thing that leads to runaway, extractive, exploitative way of doing business. But if you have appropriate constraints, a powerful narrative, and a sense of mission that is like, this is a vessel and a tool to uplift people's lives and create food independence and a new story of a path forward that we frankly we need to do. If it's not Noble Hill, it's something else. Something like this to create a path forward for growing our food locally. That's a powerful narrative that recruits really smart business people to make this happen, that we will be needing to make it successful, qualified greenhouse operators, food distribution people. But business can be a source for good with the right systems and constraints. It can also be a source for bad. But, you know, it's important to have the right mission in line because you attract the right people that way.
Just one thought on investors. I mean, Washington's been inundated with big investors coming in to buy property, and farm property in particular. Yeah. But you know, sometimes you might be okay to sort of cozy up with the bear, you know. And like the Ontario Teachers Trust spent $350 million on a farming operation in Pasco area. Bill Gates is the largest landowner in the country now. And he just lost out in Pasco to a bankruptcy down there, Easter Day Farms. It was a $200 million sale, and he lost out to the Mormon Church down there as the buyer. and the Washington Public Employees Fund has $250 million in one called International Farming. But some of these, you know, I think there'd be a compelling story to some. Quite frankly,
that's a good point.
If you can find an inlet to get in there. But someone like International Farming might be a source, because they are a little bit more altruistic thinking. They just bought Chelan Fruit for $80 million. It just is closing in a couple months. There's a lot of money rolling around out there.
Yeah.
And so how you access that as sort of your private entity, it seems like there'd be an outlet to get there.
One thing that we found, and I agree, there's a lot of money in the world that, I mean, I don't have a lot of money, unfortunately, but there are a lot of, tremendous amount of wealth. And one thing that is actually from a business professional talking to some of these large greenhouse people is not just that we've got a strong business case, that's a must have, but we have a powerful, compelling story that, just like anybody, like teaching staff, they could go anywhere to talk about stuff. They choose to come here because they want to be a part of this community. They want to be part of something bigger than themselves. And having a powerful narrative and a sense of doing good is also a competitive business advantage and an investor advantage that differentiates us from things that might have a similar return or even better return from other greenhouses, because we have that narrative that they can say to their fund manager, I want to work on this because it's helping young people get started, or it's creating a new narrative of local food sufficiency.
Yeah, it's a small slice of the total. I mean, I think there's there'd be a few other way to get there.
Compelling. That's a good insight.
Yeah, any of you may have people we should talk to, you know, or
Happy to.
We are employed for the next week on the Holden Log Crew, so.
That's right. So don't distract us now.
No, no, I can't meet with any tycoons yet, but as soon as you.
Hey, I know the chairman of REI came through here one time.
Yeah.
He might be.
I'm a member, yeah.
Yeah, me too.
As an owner, shareholder. $20 for life.
It's all right, I've got my $20 back from them.
Yeah, open and then some. Any other questions, comments?
As somebody who grew up in around dryland wheat farming, I really appreciate, and that kind of thing would be difficult to replicate on this. It's not what you're trying to do, but I've watched farms that used to be able to make it, and they can't anymore. And I appreciate the fact that you're trying to find an alternative that doesn't mean more consolidation. Because like John said, just in food marketplaces, everybody owns big farms now.
Well, if you look at the meat market, I mean, Missouri is one of the largest cattle raising operations in terms of state production. But yet all of that cattle go to other slaughterhouses. It's hardly any of it's processed in Missouri.
Yeah.
And the slaughterhouses are controlled. Four companies control 80%. Of our U.S. meat market. There's a Brazilian company, a Mexican company, a Chinese company, and I think there's one American-owned company. But between them, they really set the prices. And that's why your small farmers are being squeezed out. There's money in meat, but it goes to the four big global companies. Anyway, thank you all for your time. If you have any questions, then we'll be right back.